From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Georgians face new restrictions on voting. Governor Brian Kemp signed into law a major bill yesterday that overhauls the state's voting rules. It adds ID requirements to voting by mail, among other things, and even goes so far as making it illegal to provide food and water to voters waiting in line to cast ballots. Georgia leads a number of states where Republican lawmakers are working to pass new voting restrictions. Georgia Public Broadcasting reporter Stephen Fowler is here with more. And Stephen, I just mentioned a few of these new restrictions. What else does the new voting law do?
Well, Callum, it's a 98-page law that touches on everything from requiring more training for poll watchers to limiting the use of absentee ballot drop boxes to certain days, hours, and locations. I mean, it touches on truly every part of Georgia's law. It also expands access for in-person early voting, adding an extra Saturday for every county and allowing both Sundays to be optional.
Okay, and in sort of an olive branch, I suppose, to voting rights advocates, I know the final version of this bill didn't include all of the restrictions that were initially proposed. What was left out?
Well, like I mentioned, the early voting thing was not always destined to be an expansion. Original proposals of the bill would have limited weekend early voting to just one Saturday. Then there was an option to say one Saturday and maybe one Sunday. But now we see that expanded access. And even though the state Senate passed a law getting rid of no excuse absentee voting, several top Republican leaders like Governor Brian Kemp and House Speaker David Ralston were opposed to that measure. And ultimately, it was left on the chopping block.
Stephen, like many states, Georgia took steps to make voting easier during the pandemic last year. So I'm hoping you can help us see the bigger picture. I mean, does this new voting law simply bring Georgia back to the pre-2020 baseline, or does it actually make voting even harder than it's been in previous elections?
Well, that's a little more complicated because a year ago we didn't have the coronavirus pandemic and we didn't have absentee drop boxes, for example. So this bill actually puts drop boxes into law, but it limits how many of them can happen and where they can be and when you can use them. So in that regards, it's a little bit restrictive, but it's still more than what we had in previous years. And other changes like the absentee ID requirement are new. Previously, absentee ballots and applications were verified by using a voter's signature. Now it'll require their driver's license or state ID number. So that's something that's different. But many of the other changes, Republicans are aiming to make voting easier, they say. They include things like counties having more flexibility in how much equipment they use for lower turnout races and mandating that ballots be counted nonstop as soon as the polls close. So it'll be interesting to see how things change for Georgians and for the local elections officials that make things work.
Right. Many Democrats, of course, are not buying that idea that Republicans are actually making things easier. In fact, as the governor was signing the bill behind closed doors yesterday, there was quite a scene playing out outside of his office. Onlookers watched as state troopers arrested Georgia State Representative Park Cannon as she was knocking on the governor's door, wanting to observe the signing. Take a listen.
That's what I'm asking.
Stop arresting her.
Why are you arresting her?
Cite the violation. Cite the code.
That sound from a live stream that was online. Cannon was arrested and is facing several charges, including a felony. She has since been released from jail. But Stephen, why did troopers arrest her and what's the reaction to this?
Well, Park Cannon is a Democratic state representative. She is a young black female, and she was wanting to try to get into where the governor was holding a closed-door bill signing ceremony, and she was arrested because troopers said she was knocking on the door and disrupting an official part of the General Assembly session. And then another charge, they said that she allegedly stomped on troopers' feet as they drug her from the Capitol when she was being detained. The reaction has been really, really fierce condemnation. You have the optics of a Republican governor signing all of these voting restrictions behind closed doors while police are escorting a black female lawmaker away inside the state capitol. And so it really underscores just how divisive these issues of voting are in Georgia and nationwide.
Yeah, polarizing to be sure. And if we look at the national picture, the Brennan Center for Justice reports that as of last month, there are some 250 voting restriction laws proposed in 40 plus states. So we'll keep track of that. Stephen Fowler from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Members of Congress are sharpening their words for the leaders of some of the world's most powerful companies. But is it all talk or is regulation really coming for big tech? That's the key question coming out of yesterday's Capitol Hill testimony by the CEOs of Google, Facebook, and Twitter. It is the seventh hearing in 4 years. Kat Zakreski covered the hearings for The Washington Post, and she joins us now. Hi, Kat.
Hi, Tanya.
This was another video conference hearing focusing on combating online misinformation and disinformation. Here's the committee chair.
The dirty truth is that they are relying on algorithms to purposely promote conspiratorial, divisive, or extremist content so that they can take money, more money in ad dollars. And this is because the more outrageous and extremist the content, the more engagement and views these companies get from their users, and more views equals more money.
You wrote that lawmakers have upped their tech expertise since these hearings started a few years ago. What case were they making yesterday?
So I think we saw several different cases from lawmakers yesterday, but the overarching theme was that these tech companies are not bystanders. Their technology helps amplify harmful content online. And the, you know, overall message that we heard from the politicians was these companies need to take greater responsibility when their products are helping amplify and disseminate hate or violence or content that's exploiting children. And all of that could lead to greater momentum to overhaul some decades-old internet rules that basically prevent people from bringing lawsuits against the tech companies for the harmful content on their platforms.
Okay, I want to break this down a little bit more, but Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg disputed that his company specifically benefited from spreading lies and conspiracy theories, saying it wasn't good for the company in the long term. How did that defense go over, and how else did you hear the CEOs defending themselves?
I think lawmakers did not take that defense seriously. Their response to the companies saying that, you know, we don't benefit from hate was, then why is it so easy to find it on your platform? We really saw them try to pin the CEOs on this idea of whether or not they were responsible for some of the worst outcomes of bad content on the internet. In one round of questioning, we saw Representative Mike Doyle from Pennsylvania press the CEOs on whether they were directly responsible for the riots at the Capitol, which we all know were organized online on social media. And only Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey said yes, with a major caveat that lawmakers needed to look broadly at the internet. And that did not go over well with the lawmakers.
Well, there was also a lot of attention paid to the issue of kids on social media. Here's Representative Bill Johnson, Republican of Ohio, likening the behavior of tech companies to the tobacco industry.
Big tech is essentially handing our children a lit cigarette and hoping they stay addicted for life.
How did the CEOs respond to that line of questioning?
The CEOs were certainly on the defensive during that line of questioning. They basically made the case that the majority of their products are not intended to be used by children under the age of 13. And they talked about, you know, how seriously they take this issue. But lawmakers weren't buying that. We heard multiple lawmakers challenge them on that fact and saying, you know, that any parent knows that these services like Instagram are frequently used by children under that age. And it seemed like there was a lot of momentum to overhaul existing laws protecting children online. And that really was an issue where lawmakers made it personal. A lot of these lawmakers on this committee are parents themselves who have children and teens who have experienced bad things online. And some of them brought those stories forward as they were drilling into the CEOs.
Well, Kat, the big question is, did yesterday's hearings actually make any action more likely? As you mentioned earlier, there was more talk of revising or eliminating Section 230, the liability shield under which these companies grew so big. There was scrutiny of their business model. Democratic Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois said, quote, self-regulation has come to the end of its road. But we've actually heard that a lot of times before.
That's right. I think there was some escalation in the rhetoric in terms of the urgency to address some of these problems since this was the first hearing since the Capitol attacks. But overall, I think we heard a lot of the same things from lawmakers at yesterday's hearing. And that really, to me, underscored how broken these hearings are. Essentially, you know, this was Mark Zuckerberg's seventh time testifying in front of Congress in the last 3 years. Jack Dorsey, Sundar Pichai have also become very frequent witnesses. And it just seems that these hearings don't really elicit a lot of new information from these CEOs or really show that there's a clear path forward on regulating them.
Kat Zakreski is a technology policy reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The pandemic is not over yet. Even though more states are lifting restrictions and expanding vaccine eligibility, trends in the U.S. over the past 2 weeks show COVID-19 cases are ticking up more than 5%. The numbers in most places are nowhere near as high as the peak over the winter holidays, but public health experts say there is still reason to be cautious. Joining us is Deborah Furr Holden. She's an epidemiologist and Michigan State University's Associate Dean for Public Health Integration. Deborah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you, and I want to start by touching on what's going on in your state. Michigan's seven-day average for new COVID-19 cases is up dramatically, 122%, and that's one of the highest rates in the country. And the state is reporting more than 5,200 cases just yesterday, which is the most in a few months. So what's going on?
We've got a couple things. So we've had a lot of reopening that's happened around our state. And as you increase the opportunities for people to come in contact with other people, you're going to see more spread. This is just virus transmission 101. The more people come in contact with each other, the more spread you're going to get. So reopening has played a big part in that. We've also got this myth that people have once they've been vaccinated. And I tell people, before you're vaccinated, you honor the protocols. You wear your mask, you wash your hands, you watch your distance, you watch your density, and you watch your duration when you're out. What do you do after your vaccine? You do the same things. You wear your mask, you wash your hands, you watch your distance, your density and duration. I think a lot of people also are not honoring that. They think they've got the vaccine so they can be more relaxed. And then I think we have full-blown COVID fatigue. It's been more than a year, and I think people are tired. The vaccine has given people false hope about where we are, and I think we're seeing the impact of that. So people are letting their guard down, and that's giving way to more spread and transmission.
So that's a lot of what's going on right now. And I know part of the longer term backdrop was that in some quarters, anyway, there was fierce opposition to the lockdown measures in Michigan last year. I mean, there were armed demonstrations at the state capitol. The FBI even foiled a plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. So is this kind of resistance still a problem in Michigan as well?
I think it's a problem because, unfortunately, we've politicized the public health crisis. And unfortunately, things like not wearing a mask became a political statement, but it's not good public health. And so this collapse of politics with public health and people not honoring protocols as a way to express their political views has been a part of the problem. It's especially problematic in Michigan because we have a known high percentage of these new variants for the virus. And the variants, typically what we're seeing, are able to spread more easily and cause more disability and death. So we've got a whole lot of things happening all at the same time that are fueling this problem. And the political landscape is only making it worse.
Well, so how is the state's healthcare system handling the latest surge then?
Well, we've got a lot of, you know, really smart people with an equity-centered approach to how to address these problems. You know, dealing with people's political beliefs is something that is an undue burden in the midst of a public health crisis. It's why the laws are so important. So we do have mask mandates. We do have real tools and supports for counties and cities to be able to enforce that so that people do get to exercise some free will, but not in the midst of a public health crisis, not in a way that's going to put themselves and others in harm's way. So I think our Protect Michigan Commission has been a real strong force. It's our vaccine equity group and our COVID-19 task force. Michigan is the only state that I know of that closed the racial disparities gap in COVID cases and deaths. We were one of the first states to transparently report our problems and also the first state to solve that problem. So I have no doubt that we'll do the same thing around vaccine equity, but politics and political meddling are only making things harder.
You know, if we look at the national picture, we see that about 14% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, and more than a quarter of the population has had at least one dose of the vaccine. And President Biden is now promising 200 million shots will be in the arms by the end of his first 100 days. That was double the original goal. What are your hopes for the vaccine rollout in the coming weeks?
Well, my hope is that every human being in this country that is on a vaccine wait list or has a desire to get the vaccine has fair and equitable access to that vaccine as soon as possible. The categories that we originally created prioritize people based on risk and exposure. And I do believe that it's important that we keep those people at the front of the line. This issue around hesitancy, we're going to have to ongoingly deal with that. But if we could just get the vaccine in the arms of everybody who has been a yes, what we'll see is a cultural shift. There'll be a natural social pressure for people in their peer groups, in their family groups, in their workplaces who are a no or a no for now to get on board. So I think the real push is to get it into the arms of the people who are a yes and to do that as fairly and quickly as possible.
Deborah Furr Holden is an epidemiologist and Michigan State University's Associate Dean for Public Health Integration. Deborah, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Montana Governor Greg Gianforte made international headlines after he body slammed a reporter while running for Congress back in 2017. He pleaded guilty and was charged with misdemeanor assault. Now Gianforte is getting global attention again after he trapped and shot a Yellowstone wolf. The Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie has the story.
Yellowstone National Park is known for a lot of things. It's geysers, it's grizzly bears, and it's wolves. There are around 90 or so of the animals living within the park, and they're pretty famous.
People from all over the world come to Yellowstone specifically to see these wolves.
That's Jonathan Proctor. He's with the environmental nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife. He says wolves are protected within Yellowstone, but if they wander outside the park,
they can so easily be just killed.
That's because it's legal to hunt and trap wolves in neighboring states such as Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana, as long as the wolf has stepped outside of the park's boundaries. And that was the fate of a black male Yellowstone wolf known as 1155. He was born inside the park a few years ago, and he became one of the wolves biologists track using a radio collar. But recently, 1155 wandered outside of Yellowstone, likely in search of a new mate. Instead, though, he found a trap set by Montana's governor, Greg Gianforte. Gianforte killed the trapped wolf on February 15th on a private ranch about 10 miles north of Yellowstone. Perfectly legal, except Gianforte still got in trouble with Montana wildlife officials because he failed to take a required wolf trapping certification course before killing the animal. John Sullivan is with the sportsman's group Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and he says this course, it's like taking driver's ed before you drive.
It's a really good thing to do so that the people who are engaging in this sport understand what they're doing, they're educated, they're safe.
And they learn how to trap wolves ethically and more humanely, such as checking traps every day and killing the wolf quickly, with a gun, as soon as you find it. Plus, this class is required. Everyone who traps wolves has to take it. But Gianforte didn't. And after he killed his wolf, he was issued a written warning by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. The governor's spokesperson said Gianforte made a, quote, mistake, and he's since taken the class, but Sullivan said the governor should have known better.
He has been hunting and trapping in Montana for a long time. And I would be surprised to learn that he didn't know better than to finish that class, to complete that education. And we hope that he apologizes to the citizens of the state for, you know, circumventing the process that we all have to go through.
But Nick Jivak with the conservation nonprofit Montana Wildlife Federation takes a more measured approach. He says, sure, Gianforte screwed up by not taking the class, but he also followed all the other rules.
It was within the bounds of the season, and the only violation in this case was lack of that course.
He says it's a teachable moment for Gianforte. Still, the governor's actions have drawn the ire of other prominent environmental organizations and animal protection groups, including the Humane Society of the United States. Amanda White says the governor got off easy.
He might have received a slap on the wrist in the form of a written warning, but this is really a slap in the face to the millions of people that, you know, come to his state to see these wolves.
She says an iconic and famous animal like the Yellowstone wolf deserves better. She also argues that wolf traps are inhumane.
They're extremely cruel.
She says they hold animals until they either injure themselves trying to escape or they're killed by hunters. New Mexico recently banned trapping on public lands there, but it's still legal across most of the Mountain West, including Montana, where the legislature is trying to expand trapping opportunities for wolves. In fact, Republicans are currently pushing a suite of bills that would drastically reduce the number of wolves in the state through hunting and trapping. There are roughly 850 wolves in Montana these days. And Gianforte, he's in charge of signing those bills into law. For Here and Now, I'm Nate Hedgey in Missoula, Montana.
And now an update on the NASA rover Perseverance. It's been on the surface of Mars for about 5 weeks now, and we're closing in on another big milestone for the mission, one which contains a small piece of history. On board the rover is a 4-pound helicopter, and it represents NASA's hope for the first powered, controlled flight ever on another planet. The space agency will make its first attempt to fly the helicopter in the next 2 weeks as part of its study of the Martian surface. And taped to that helicopter is a postage stamp-sized piece of memorabilia, a fabric swatch from the flyer that the Wright brothers built and flew in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, on December 17, 1903. The Wright brothers' great-grandniece and great-grandnephew, Amanda Wright Lane and Stephen Wright, gave their blessing for this special mission, saying in a statement, "Wilbur and Orville Wright would be pleased to know that a little piece of their 1903 Wright Flyer 1, the machine that launched the space age by barely one quarter of a mile, is going to soar into history again on Mars."
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we talk about what we're watching, listening to, or just trying to figure out, like what concert films you should watch if you miss live music, and great books to read alone or in your book club. All of that in around 20 minutes every weekday. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Mexico is now the third country with more than 200,000 deaths from COVID-19, joining the United States and Brazil at that grim milestone. But critics say the real death toll in Mexico is even higher. The BBC's Will Grant joins us from Mexico City. Will, is there any evidence that the government there is undercounting the number of people killed by COVID?
Well, the federal government of President Andrés Manuel López Obrador stopped publishing the figures of excess deaths in Mexico towards the end of last year, about autumn of last year. And so we haven't been able to really get a handle on that figure. But in Mexico City, obviously a huge capital city with, you know, upwards of 12 to 15 million people in it, the excess deaths figure is around 46% higher than it was in the same period last year. So a lot of people have been using those figures, have been collating them with figures in different states to suggest that the actual figure, basically that Mexico passed that 200,000 milestone quite some weeks ago, and in fact now is probably far closer to 300,000, which, if true, is obviously a very, very worrying figure. And of course, would take into account the fact that so many people, and there is evidence to support this, are simply dying at home and never making it to the hospitals in the first place.
Well, along those lines, we're reading an Associated Press account that includes a quote from a funeral home worker who says he's seeing households with two, three people all at once dying from COVID. What is happening in Mexico right now? Is this a full-blown additional wave of the pandemic?
I think I'm reminded of an interview and a conversation I had with a young man who had COVID. He got it and got it very, very badly. And the only person who was able to look after him was his mother, because he couldn't find a bed. He didn't have insurance. He couldn't find a bed in the public hospitals, so had to ride it out at home. In the process of looking after him, his mother, who was obviously a more vulnerable age, got it. And they simply couldn't find a hospital for her, despite trying 50 in Mexico City and surrounding states. When they did eventually find a bed for her, it was essentially too late. And I think that kind of image, that kind of story, is a good example of what many, many, many thousands of families, not just in the capital, Mexico City, where I am, but across the country, have been through.
Well, here in the U.S., we have vaccines rolling out from Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, Pfizer, and so we know the U.S. is shipping more than 1 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico. Is that helping with the rollout there?
I think anything would be welcomed at this stage. Mexico has been characterized as reacting very, very slowly, I think, in the vaccination program. And I think that has been a frustration for so many. And they look at, say, Chile, which is leading the region, arguably leading the world in vaccinating its population in a timely fashion, in a well-organized fashion. But the reality is this is a complex country with very, very different realities from one end of it to the other. And it isn't an easy place to sort of join up. Nevertheless, I do think it is a fair criticism that there hasn't been enough preparation, there hasn't been enough forward thinking. And although that 1 million or so doses that you mentioned is always going to be helpful, they need a heck of a lot more and they need them quickly.
The BBC's Will Grant in Mexico City. Will, thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure, as always.
A lot of us over the last few years have been having heated political debates with family members. But what happens when both sides can't agree on a set of facts? Journalist Albert Samaha understands this well. His mother is a staunch supporter of QAnon, and he's struggled to convince her that the far-right conspiracy theory is a lie. He's written about this in his latest article for BuzzFeed News called "My Mom Believes in QAnon. I've Been Trying to Get Her Out." And Albert joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yes. So, you know, I wanted to talk with you about this because you're laying bare something that so many of us are experiencing. What made you take the step to write about your mom?
Writing is just kind of how I process problems and traumas I encounter. It's cathartic to put it on paper. It forced me to reckon with everything I had in the story that I hadn't really fully thought through. And I think writing it out and going through that process with my mom really helped me get a better understanding of what it is we had gone through and how it had impacted our relationship.
Let's talk a little bit about what these conspiracy theories mean for your mother, what she's connecting to. During your mom's first decade living in the United States, you write that she was actually very indifferent to politics, mostly because she wasn't a citizen, so she couldn't vote yet. You're also in the process of writing a book about your family's experiences with immigration from the Philippines. How do you think your mother's political evolution coincides with that experience? Do you think she's still reconciling the differences between maybe the American ideal and the reality?
I think she came to the country inherently skeptical of government because of the experience she had in the Philippines, her household being flipped upside down when President Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law and sort of ushering in that dictatorship and a lot of the corruption that followed even the revolution in that country left her a bit disillusioned with the role of government. So she had always sort of put God above all and seen government as merely just a tool, a piece on his chessboard. I mean, I think her conspiratorial mindset sort of bloomed from those years in the Philippines where the dictatorship was bolstered by actual conspiracies. You know, I mean, there's a million conspiracies that have happened in the U.S. over the course of time that we're only finding out recently, right? Like, I'm sure at the time, the Tuskegee experiments would have seemed like an absurd conspiracy if I had heard about it, or the CIA, supplying crack cocaine in low-income neighborhoods would have seemed like a conspiracy. And so I think the existence of these conspiracies is what sort of validated, in my mom's mind, the conspiracies that I do find baseless, because it's like, well, what truly is possible? And so her evolution towards caring about politics sort of came through the lens of Donald Trump represented the person who's standing up to these conspiracies that she had long believed in.
You know, QAnon is based on the idea that government leaders and Hollywood stars are these secret Satan worshipers and are part of a massive child sex trafficking plot. There's another one that basically believes that key political figures like President Biden and Obama and others will be rounded up and executed. Is there any part of the QAnon conspiracy theory umbrella that you've been able to convince your mother may be wrong?
Yes. I mean, it's funny with my mom because, like, there are certain aspects of QAnon where she'll sort of surprise me by being like, "Yeah, I don't know if Tom Hanks was actually cloned." Like the concession she'll make sometimes, it's like, "Okay, maybe that one's not true, but who knows?" type of thing. And usually that's only been the case for like not even outlandish stuff. I would say actually some of the lower stakes stuff. So like she'll back down from like whether Oprah's a clone, but she won't back down from like whether Joe Biden's a clone, because that's much more central to like her belief system, the ideology, and like her political beliefs. Whereas like she doesn't really care about whether a celebrity's a clone. So the stuff she'll get persuaded on is the stuff that she doesn't really care about. But on like the issues she cares about, she has enough sort of confirmation from her like fake news sources to not have to back down about like Biden being a body double and the deep state trying to topple Trump.
I want to get into the larger meaning behind you processing this relationship. But first, I want to know, how is your mom reacting to this piece?
She's good. She's reacting very positively. You know, she likes the story. She found it funny. She hopes that people can find it useful for navigating their own situations.
Well, it's clear that your mother from your article is very proud of you, even if she doesn't always agree with what you cover as an investigative reporter. And you write that for a while, the only stories your mom actually found credible in what she called the mainstream media were the ones that you actually wrote. Can you describe how that shifted as she became more aligned with the QAnon ideology?
You know, in some ways, I don't even know if the shift had much to do with the QAnon stuff. I think because in some ways, her perspective on my work personally hasn't shifted. It's that she generally trusts what I have to say, you know, when I publish stories, except when those stories undermine the ideas she holds dear. So if anything, I think where the QAnon stuff did impact that was that there were just so many more theories that my reporting was now clashing with. QAnon was just sort of one slice of the disinformation that had formed this wedge between us. So when I hear from folks that tell me about how stunning it was for them to go through this QAnon divergence with their loved ones, I kind of realized that one benefit my mom and I had is that we've navigated these waters for a decade now.
You and your mom are doing this really delicate dance. You still have a wonderful relationship, it seems, but you're constantly navigating this big thing here. Do you feel like you're any closer to having a deeper understanding of where you are and where perhaps the rest of society or mainstream society is?
I don't know. I think that we've talked about the possibility of just avoiding the subject altogether, but the thing is, these are important issues, right? Like both of our worldviews and the things we argue about are of the utmost importance, right? They concern democracy, authoritarianism. Like what we argue about are these really important fundamental issues about the world, and we both feel that they're much too important to not talk about, to not try to persuade the other person. So we sort of we decided that it would be impossible for us to just not talk about it and avoid the subject. So I think where we have found progress is in our ability to talk about it and put up objections and tell each other when we believe the other is wrong without doing so in a way that is disrespectful or dismissive or smug or anything like that. And just sort of accepting that we see the world in two different ways and we will both continue to try to persuade each other, but that disagreement doesn't have to define our relationship. It doesn't have to entirely consume us.
Is that in a way your takeaway message from this article? Because so many people, as we said at the beginning of our conversation, are dealing with this with family members and loved ones. But I think the other side of this is that a lot of people feel that it's more than just a disagreement that we can agree to disagree, that there are bigger things at stake, like democracy, like the humanization of Black and brown people in this country. And so when there are all of these conspiracy theories that people who have power through voting and other means can take a stand on, how do you reconcile that at the end of the day?
Everyone has kind of their own relationship. Like, I don't think that the way my mom and I have handled it offers any sort of like guidance or antidote for other people's problems. For me, I could never imagine cutting off my mom or any loved one for having abhorrent beliefs. But like, what's the line, you know? Like, how far does someone have to slip into having beliefs that I find immoral before I have to take a further stand? I don't know. I mean, I sort of just take it one day at a time. And I don't know if that would work for everybody. I don't know if everyone even wants that. I totally understand how frustrating it is to be on like this side of the line. And not just how frustrating it is, but how much of an emotional drain it is, right? How much emotional labor it takes to carry that. And I totally understand and empathize with folks that aren't willing to put up with that.
Well, Albert, I thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
That's BuzzFeed News reporter Albert Samaha talking about his recent essay, "My Mom Believes in QAnon. I've been trying to get her out." After 5 years and 6 seasons, the NBC show Superstore has come to an end. The under-the-radar gem followed a zany group of employees at a Walmart-like store called Cloud9, and it was known for its representation of race and working-class people. Here's a clip.
You say nine, Cloud9. Cloud9. When I say team, you say work, team.
Work.
Team.
Work.
Are we Cloud1?
No.
Are we Cloud2?
No.
Are we Cloud3?
No.
Are we Cloud5?
This chant seems a little on the long side.
It gets longer every year.
When I first started here, we would just put our hands in the middle and go, yay.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here to talk more about it. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Superstore had a Latina lead, America Ferrera, for most of its run. What has the show done well in terms of accurate portrayals of working class people and people of color?
I always thought this was a cute comedy that very slyly talked about a lot of things that were going on in American society that needed to be talked about. So, you know, one of the characters was an undocumented immigrant who, once they realized he was undocumented, they had to figure out, like, how do we keep him employed at this store, you know, so that he can stay in the country. The storyline of the series finale is that the corporation that owns this Walmart-like store is going to close most of its retail outlets and probably going to close the one that all these characters work at. And they all have to figure out, like, what are we going to do now that this thing is going away? And, you know, they reflected the pandemic. The pandemic is happening in their fictional world. So it was just a way of sort of having a workplace comedy that talks about the kinds of jobs that you don't often see in sitcoms. You know, sitcoms are a lot of times are aspirational. And so the jobs that people have are often white collar. They're often middle class. They're often set in offices where, you know, people are gathered around a water cooler or something. This is a job where it's the service industry, and they're dealing with people who come into a store all the time, and they're worried about overtime, and they're worried about whether they're going to make assistant manager or not. You know, things that working class people go through.
5 years is a long time for a show like this. What other shows are following in its footsteps without really trying too hard to come off as performative?
Well, you know, I think that's the problem. Like, what other shows out there are talking about this kind of stuff, especially on broadcast television? I think that's the challenge. You know, we've had a really weird year in a lot of different ways, but the broadcast TV industry just took a really huge hit thanks to COVID. The lockdown started happening right when the TV networks were going to start filming pilot episodes to figure out which new shows they were going to bring to the air in September of 2020. And it made it tough for broadcast networks to develop new programming. And so I think the new programming that we've seen over the past year from the broadcast networks has been much, we've seen a lot less of it, and it's been at a lower quality because they just have not quite gotten the engine restarted.
Well, something else I want to ask you about regarding the industry. Disney is slated to release Black Widow and Cruella on Disney Plus the same day the films are released in theaters. Even if media companies have a commitment to theaters, is the pandemic forcing them to make streaming a bigger part of their release plans? I mean, what does this mean for the future of the theater business?
Yeah, you know, and I think I've said this before. I feel like the pandemic has just accelerated trends in media that we already saw happening beforehand. So there was already this sense that the future of the media business might be in streaming, and that these big media companies like Disney and Warner Media would be shifting internal resources to make more product for their streaming platforms. And the pandemic just accelerated that because so many people stuck at home and so many people turning for entertainment to streaming platforms, there was a greater need to beef up those streaming platforms. And I also think that it revealed that the streaming services that do best are the streaming services that have a huge library, right? Netflix did well because it had a huge library and a huge subscriber base. Disney Plus did well because it debuted with a huge library that cuts across all the media platforms that Disney owns. And now you're seeing, for example, Paramount Plus, which is owned by ViacomCBS, they're talking about investing billions of dollars to increase the amount of content that they have on their service. And, you know, all these streaming services are now trying to figure out how to compete. It's almost like an arms race for content. And even once we get to the point where a lot of people are vaccinated and it feels like the world is returning to normal, I'm not sure that sitting in an enclosed space with a bunch of other people that you don't know is going to be something that's high on anybody's list to do, you know? So I think that's the challenge that movie theaters face, is that the pandemic has kind of removed movie theaters from a lot of people's entertainment equation for long enough that there may be a huge percentage of the audience that just decides, you know, I don't need to do that anymore.
Never go
I don't need
back.
To have that in my life anymore.
As always, thank you so much, Eric.
All right. Thank you.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.